All right, listeners, welcome into another Pro Football Weekly podcast edition. We're getting closer to the draft, so we figured it was a great time to bring in the one and only Dan Hatman from Inside the Pylon. He does an outstanding job with them. And welcome to the show, Dan. First time here, I believe.
I believe so. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I want to, you know, I want our listeners to know kind of what you do. And first of all, if you guys haven't been able to check it out yet, do so. The 2018 ITP Draft Guide. Phenomenal work this year. I mean, you guys have just built this thing up into something phenomenal. I've had a chance to read about 10 or 12 of the profiles. Haven't gotten through all of them yet. There's only so much time in the day, but what I've read, I mean, I use it as a cross-check, just make sure I'm not losing my mind on some of these guys I'm watching on tape. So tell people about the product, and I believe you have a little bit of a promotion as well.
Yeah, so, you know, the day job affords me a great opportunity over at the Scouting Academy to work with a lot of people that want to get into this industry. And this year, we had a couple dozen alumni that wanted to start doing draft work for their own portfolios, just for experience. And so I had already been assisting the group over at Inside the Pylon, kind of helped them with their grading scales and whatnot last year, and just brought everybody together. And so we ended up with 50 scouts and another 20 in support staff. So we had a staff of 70 people that went into this. They graded over 550 players. We have over 1,000 reports in because our guys cross-checked each other. Really just blown away. I just got to kind of sit back and be the college director on this and really work on the polish and asking questions. And if I'd watch a guy and I wasn't quite in the same place, you know, again, drive discussion, really wanted this to be their work and just unbelievably impressed by what they put together. And they're not in sync with some of the narratives that are out there, which is awesome. And so excited to see how people respond to it. And so, as you mentioned, if you go over to itpdraftguide.com, we've actually got a promo code for you listeners out there. Nice. PFW5 will get you $5 off the draft guide.
Outstanding. Great. Well, I hope people will take advantage of that. I would if you hadn't already sent me an advanced copy, but I will be passing that on to my friends. And I like what you said about kind of defeating the narratives a little bit and killing off some of the groupthink that exists. And was there – are there some topics this year? We can get to – actually, I'll tell you what. Let me circle back with your experience too. First of all, tell people kind of your football background a little bit and where you've come from to get to this point. You mentioned the academy. I know you do a series of teaching sessions. You've got another one, I believe, in mid-May coming up, your summer session. So tell the listeners about that and also your background a little bit in football.
So my first start in football was at the University of Albany as a volunteer student assistant coach. And I got fortunate. I tell everybody it was luck as opposed to skill. They got me in the NFL. That's where the Giants did training camp.
Right.
And so my work there at Albany led to them recommending me to the Giants, which led to my first internship. I was with them my first full year in the league. I got spoiled rotten. I got to be a part of Super Bowl 42 and that victory. From there, I went to the University of Massachusetts after the Giants as a defensive line and special teams coach, then to the Jets, and then to the Eagles, where I was a pro scout, meaning I did more work on the advancing opponents and free agents than I did on the draft at those stops. And then in 2013, was looking at a change, had this concept that became the Academy. Believe that we could provide people with a more formal education on this industry prior to them having to go jump off the cliff and do it for real. And so we're in year four, and I'm proud to say to date we've got 15 alumni working in the NFL.
Oh, that's outstanding. And you and I have talked about the program off podcast and off air and just casually here and there. And, you know, it's been exciting for me to watch you grow it year to year. And what is the process that is most important for you in teaching somebody? Because there is this interest out there. I mean, people who casually watch the game start to understand the X and O's better now, and I think that they did a generation ago. And you have people who understood the game on a pretty moderately high level now are digging deep into some really, you know, deep stuff that I think the average fan wouldn't have any clue about a generation ago. So how do you tailor your programs you know, to people of, let's say, you know, different levels of football knowledge?
So it really begins with pushing back on what I call the lowest common denominator of evaluation, right? So we can simply look at the result of a play, you know, running back scores a touchdown and go, oh, that running back must be good.
Right.
He scored a touchdown. That's the lowest common denominator evaluation. You can just simply see the results. You make a causal inference to what just happened, and then that's it. And that you've locked that in as your assessment of the player. Where when you really want to get into it, you want to try to figure out, did the running back contribute mm-hmm. above and beyond to the point where you can credit him with generating that? And it happens all the time. It happens all the time where a player will go and they will generate production. They will be the cause of it, and you absolutely want to give them credit for when that happens. But what happens if the play would have potentially gained a number of yards but not been a touchdown if it hadn't been for the left guard doing a phenomenal job of working up to the second level and sealing a linebacker?
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't get to that linebacker, the linebacker makes a tackle. Maybe, again, it's a 6-7 yard gain. Everybody goes home happy, but certainly doesn't break it for a touchdown. Well, then the running back gets some credit. But now we got to look at the guard and give him a lot more credit. And so at the end of the day, it's just root cause analysis.
Yep.
I mean, that's what we're doing here. It's less about did production occur and more about why did production occur.
Yep.
Because we're all trying to predict the future. Because everything that's happened on film is it's in the past. It's done. So every time we watch film, we're watching past performance.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody, I don't care if you're in fantasy football, I don't care if you're an NFL GM, all you're trying to do is predict what the next outcome is going to be.
Correct.
Who's the player that's going to get me there? What's the scheme? What's the coach? You know, we all just want to win. So everything's about future performance. Everything's about projecting to the next level. And so for us as an educational institution, it's about getting people to understand if you can drill down to why the production occurred, whether a player succeeds or fails, you've got a much better chance of predicting future outcomes.
Yeah, and then it was while you were saying that, it made me think of a play I watched a couple of days ago. I watched it live at the time, and of course you don't really get to see the little nuggets until you play it, run it back, slow it down, all that stuff. It was the Sony Michel touchdown against Oklahoma, the 70-whatever mm-hmm. yarder. You know, I think I could have run for about 42 on that play, you know, and so it made me think, hey, I would never use this play as an example of his skill. Not that it wasn't, you know, not that he didn't show some good, you know, game speed on that play, but hey, that line did the job. The receivers downfield were blocking. So that's the kind of scouting nuggets I think a lot of people are seeking. Now, back to what I was kind of teeing up earlier, big picture with this draft, and I know you've had a chance to kind of oversee things and, you know, maybe not drill down on as many individual players, but do you have a general takeaway for this 2018 draft? There's a lot of excitement about the quarterbacks. There's, you know, some other players who I think are getting some attention. Does it feel to you, and I know there are players every year, but does it feel to you like it's a quote-unquote good draft in your eyes?
The draft has a number of very good players.
Mm-hmm.
The draft has a number of good players, and the draft has a number of interesting players. The difficult thing this year is that – so I test people – or I shouldn't say test. I offer an exercise. If you want to figure out what you value, if you were the GM, what you value is a yep. simple exercise I think you should go through. Take 11 personnel, a three-receiver set, yep. so those 11 offensive players, and then take the defense that would face that, so nickel. Those are the two most common personnel groups. Those are the most common 22 players on the field in the NFL. And assume in a vacuum all 22 of those players are good. Not more, not less. They're all just good. Stack those position groups in terms of how much value do you think they bring to a team.
Mm-hmm.
So easily, I think everybody put quarterback number one.
Sure.
And then you start working from there. And discussions immediately occur by the second position. Do you want to put pass rusher? Do you want to put the pass protector? Is it the corner? Is it the wideout the corner goes against? You immediately start going into this discussion phase. And it's a relevant discussion. The positions that historically have been of a decreased value, interior offensive line,
yep.
safety, linebacker, running back. This draft has those positions in the, at the premium tier, whereas some of the positions that historically have held much greater value, again, wide receiver, offensive tackle, pass rusher, corner, quarterback. They certainly have some names, but not necessarily as many in other draft classes. And so what I think the market's doing is they're trying to find reasons to pull down guards and linebackers and running backs and say, you know, they're not as good or they shouldn't go as high. And they're pushing up players at other positions, particularly quarterback, to try to fill in because we want the premium positions. We want pass rushers. We want wide receivers. We want quarterbacks. So we're kind of pushing them up in the market, and we're kind of pull back on the other guys so it won't look so crazy. Because if you just draft this class based on purely what's on film right now, you're going to have, again, more interior offensive linemen, safeties, and running backs in the top 15 than anybody could have imagined.
Yeah. And I didn't even share the script with you. I have kind of a loose script here in front of me, and you lead me right into my next question, which was, you know, we haven't had too many years in the past, even, you know, putting the quarterbacks to the side for just a moment. They go high because they're, you know, there's a need there. Obviously, there's some talent as well. But the two players who seem to be, if not people's one and two prospects overall, regardless of position, certainly in the top five, are Quentin Nelson, who's played offensive guard. Maybe he's a tackle, who knows, but let's say he's a guard. And the other guy is Saquon Barkley from Penn State. And, you know, is he a perfect prospect? No, but he is widely regarded as a special talent. So, you know, that kind of leads right into your discussion. How high do they deserve to go? And I realize there's a million ways to answer this question, but let's start with Nelson. Are you comfortable with the idea of a team taking him in the top 3, 4, 5 slots of the draft?
I am, and I'm confident I'm in the minority.
Okay.
On that. I will be the dissenting opinion on the guard being that high, and I'm just going to say a few names, and hopefully I don't need to say more in terms of my argument. Aaron Donald, Geno Atkins, Fletcher Cox, Ndamukong Suh, Gerald McCoy, need I go on?
Right.
Like, those guys are in the quarterback's lap a lot. They're lined up at the three technique, which means they attack the guard. So the days of undervaluing a guard because he doesn't face a premium pass rusher is, to me, lacks merit and logic. In fact, the ball is out of the quarterback's hand faster than it's ever been, which means outside pass rush has less time than it's ever had to get home. So interior pass rush is what screws up every quarterback. So, yes, I have – if you don't need a quarterback and you don't take Nelson in the top five, I don't know what we're doing here.
Yeah, shame on you. Right, exactly. And you're right. I think there's all those reasons, the quality interior rushers, the speed of the game, all those things, being closer to the ball makes a lot of sense. Teams are being creative with how they use guards in terms of getting them out into space and pulling them and all that stuff. Regarding Barkley, I mean, is there any hesitation for you given that, you know, again, you talked about the causality of, hey, you know, look, he had some games or some halves of games where he was neutralized or they had to only throw him the ball or, you know, whatever it was. And then finally he breaks the long run and his numbers look pretty good. You know, just big picture, any hesitation with him, any concern with him as far as just being a little bit hot and cold or maybe the kind of guy you have to scheme to get the ball to a little bit?
I don't have an issue with him.
Okay.
But if I go back to that exercise on stacking the positions, I've never been able to get the running back higher than 20 out of 22.
Yep.
And so I point to Todd Gurley a couple years ago. So I've always thought the world of Todd Gurley as a football player, pre, post injury, doesn't matter to me. I think he's been a phenomenal player for a long, long time. Take Todd Gurley's 2016 season, which happened to be Jared Goff's rookie year, and look at what was produced in that offense with him. Then take Todd Gurley in 2017, when McVay gets there, Goff really blossoms, they add a couple offensive linemen, things really start going. We got an offensive player of the year.
Yep.
So I don't think the running back changed between 2016 and 2017, I don't think there was a massive difference in what Gurley was bringing to the table between 1 year and the next. I think there was a massive difference in how that offense extracted that from him between 2016 and 2017. So I struggle mightily unless you're the Dallas Cowboys and at 4 you can take Ezekiel Elliott because you have a lot of other pieces in place. the offensive line, wide receivers, quarterback, competent defense, and you can actually extract that value from him, which they did, more power to you. If you're still putting that together, like if I'm the New York Giants, for example, and there's still question marks as to how my offensive line is going to play, I would pass on Barkley, add more pieces a la Nelson, if I'm not looking at a quarterback, and then address the Nick Chubb, Rashard Penny, Kerryon Johnson, Royce Freeman cluster if Michael and Jones don't fall in the second or third round, and still walk away with an incredibly good player and probably have a better offense for it.
Yep. And you know, you just you know, brought up a great point too, which is scouting is also, you know, eight dimensional in the sense that, hey, it's not just Saquon Barkley in this class. There are other talented running backs we've seen in recent years. You can find talent third, fourth round, undrafted for that matter. But yeah, I mean, you can still find day three, day, you know, undrafted talents who can be very good players at that position as well. So that also.
Alfred Morris was one of my favorite players. Oh, sure. The study when I was scouting in Philly, he was in Washington at the time.
Yep.
I was a 1,600-yard a season guy in the Shanahan's offense there because he knew how to execute that zone scheme to a T. Not because he was necessarily a premium athlete at his position, but he was a darn good football player there, and he was a sixth-round pick. Now, that doesn't – I mean, I'm also not saying that you're going to get – Pro Bowl caliber, like you're not going to find, you know, Le'Veon Bell in the sixth round, per se. But day two, a second, third round player is we see a lot more of those guys producing at a higher level because they go to better landing spots, better places where they can have that ability extracted than necessarily the guys who get going in the first round.
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite Alfred Morris story, I saw his preseason debut with the Redskins, right? You said sixth-round pick. He started the game, which, of course, caught my attention a little bit. I was surprised. I know the Shanahan history of backs being drafted very low and having success. And first or second play of the game, they run a little draw, and here's Alfred Morris dropping his shoulder and knocking Lance Briggs, you know, borderline Hall of Fame linebacker on his tail. And I went, oh, hello, you know, and who's this guy? And so, yeah, it is always fun to see those players emerge. We're here with Dan Hatman, Inside the Pylon, does great work with them as well as the Scouting Academy. And I've got to know Dan over the past couple of years, respect his scouting opinions very much. And I guess the lightning rod player in this draft is Josh Allen, and you know, really, you know him, right? Yeah, it's such a and this really lends to what you do very well, which is the teaching aspect, the prioritizing of draft qualities and things like that. With him, can you get, you know, we're talking about a 56% passer in the Mountain West, somebody who regressed statistically his final year. Maybe wasn't playing with very good players, freshman center, lost four guys in the NFL, all that stuff. Where are you with him, and what are the potential pitfalls and also, you know, the promise of a potentially great quarterback maybe?
So I'm going to share a little anecdote. I was on a show, or I guess it has to be 2 years ago or three, whenever it was the Goff Wentz were coming out.
Yep.
And a pre-draft show, and, you know, who's your favorite quarterback? And I said, okay, on the film, in college, I give a slight nod to Jared Goff. And they said, okay, so you think Jared Goff's going to be the better NFL player? And I said, I never said that. they were kind of confused, like, well, what do you mean? Like, you asked me who I think the better player is. Right now, based on the college film,
right,
I think the better player is Jared Goff by a little bit. I'll tell you this, whoever goes to Philadelphia, because they'd already traded up for number two at that point, whoever goes to Philly, I think I'll have a better pro career.
Interesting.
They're like, well, how could that be? Isn't one better than the other? I said, not demonstrable. Like, there's not, it's not head and shoulders where it's, you know, there's clear cut, no questions asked. He's going to be better pro no matter what. Philadelphia had a much better setup with all those coaching pieces in place. You know, again, Doug Peterson, Frank Reich, who just went to Indianapolis as the head coach, John DeFilippo, who just went to Minnesota as the offensive coordinator. All those things in place had me more excited than the staff that they had in Los Angeles at the time, which they've since rectified. So I come to this class, and it's the same thing. Right now, we can talk about what they showed on their college tape, and I will absolutely happy to share kind of the stack in terms of how I see them based on what they showed in their college tape. Where they land is more important. Patrick Mahomes going to Kansas City is an unbelievable resource for him. The things that he had between his ears, you heard phenomenal stories up. Clearly, the arm talent was there. The film didn't always live up to that coming out of college. There were exciting moments, but it wasn't consistent, or he would have been thought of more highly universally. But he goes to Kansas City, immediately becomes my favorite quarterback coming out of that draft class last year. Mm-hmm. Whereas Deshaun Watson going in was the one I had favored above him.
Okay.
But getting with Andy, who I know, having worked with him, is a phenomenal developer at the quarterback position.
Yep.
I was way more excited than I had been pre-draft about someone like that. So to answer your question, Alan, I'd be scared in a vacuum. Without looking at landing spots, there's no team attached to him right now.
Yep.
It's scary because I get why some people like him, but I had a hard time that I'm going to put my career, honey, pack the boxes. We might be moving at the end of the season on the line for the young man based on what I've seen on his tape. But if you get with the right spot, I kind of joke now since I was introduced to the player. If I had Bruce Arians as my head coach and quarterback developer,
uh-huh,
I'm probably way more excited about Josh Allen than maybe another coach.
Yeah.
The way Bruce's system works, the way he works, what have you. Now, he's since retired. It's not really a viable option. But my point was, depending on where you're telling me he's going and how much you had to give up to get him, I could get excited. If I'm going to take him top five and he might not go to a place that has a great situation for him to develop, I don't know if we're going to be sitting here a couple years from now looking at a player that's, moving towards an upper tier NFL quarterback.
Yeah, and that's obviously subject to question with maybe the Browns, the Jets, who knows, the Bills, whatever. I mean, I'm not knocking those coaching staffs or the talent, but they're not as enticing perhaps as some other landing spots might be for a young quarterback. We don't know if Hugh Jackson's going to be here a year from now. We, Todd Bowles, same situation. If he doesn't win this year, who knows, and change of system after 1 year, all those things. Now, that worked out well for Jared Goff, but it doesn't always work out that well. So a great point for you. This one just came to my head real quick, and it's one of those things that I've thought about but never been able to really quantify or really get behind. The subject of age, we have a player who's going to turn 20 in May, and Tremaine Edmonds, the Virginia Tech linebacker, looks the part, exciting upside, all that stuff. And then you have a player like Calvin Ridley, who, is 24 years old. He's 6 months younger than Amari Cooper, who's going into his fourth year. Does age bother you one way or another? Either a guy, is it a factor how much of a factor is it, I should say, when you're thinking about a prospect and where he is now and where he could be?
The teams I was with had an age flag. Now, what they said is that threshold, there was some variance there, whether it was, 23 and a half,
yeah,
four, was it 23 or whatever the number was. So the kind of what I was presented is the general rule of thumb was like under 23 is pretty standard.
Mm-hmm.
These guys get to their senior year. They got into school 18, 19 years old. They're there for 4, maybe 5 years if they redshirt. Then 23 is reasonable to get a senior out and into the NFL. If you're over that, now we've got, again, some question marks. As I've seen people in the external evaluation space continue to do research on age, it's intriguing that guys that present a higher skill set at an earlier age have a good chance. I don't think age in a vacuum. Like, I'm not going to just randomly take a guy that I have a third day grade on,
sure,
higher just because he happens to be 20. But if you were to present me with two players that I have either in the same tier or maybe tightly from one tier to the next, and you were to say one of the guys is 21 and one of the guys is 24,
right,
I'm going to have to seriously consider looking at, in this hypothetical, the 21-year-old would be, again, a notch down or what have you. I'd seriously look at the 21-year-old because they've been able to present clearly a similar film profile to get that grade at a younger age.
Yep.
It's intriguing. There's something there. At the same time, again, in a draft like this with a guy like Ridley, I'm not going to shy away from him from being 24. He's one of the top you know, if he's not the top, he's one of the top two. I haven't heard anybody put him past three in the class.
Right.
Like he's again, a darn good player. Now, because he's so technically proficient and he is 24, maybe you don't anticipate a massive development curve or upside and recognize that what he's presenting is probably going to be immediately transferable. You might not get, you know, there's not many weaknesses he's going to turn into strengths in the NFL. But that doesn't mean he can't come in and play at a very high level. So I would use it more. I use the term kind of breaking up clusters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't see it. Everybody gets in the idea of stacking or rankings, you know, one, two, whatever, however far you want to go down, my top 50, my top 100, my top 300. Yes, there are some teams that do get to a final vertical stacking at some point. But generally speaking, you work horizontally, so you have a quarterback column and a tight end column and a linebacker column, and you work within that to stack your players. And so guys cluster certain classes. Again, we talk about this. There's the running back. There's a big cluster at the top,
yep,
and another cluster on the second day. And then, you know, third day is kind of a free-for-all anyway. Again, interior offensive line, massive cluster at the top. You know, cornerback, for example, is one with – there's a bunch of really good guys at the top of the class, and then it falls off, and you might not be looking at an outside-lean starter that you love come early day three.
Yep.
And you're going to be banking on upside pretty quickly in that class. So when you have those clusters where guys are tightly put together for whatever reason, you got to break that up. You got to decide, how am I going to work through that and determine who I think is best. That is absolutely a place where I would look at age.
Okay. Great. And as we finish up here, wrap up here on the Pro Football Weekly podcast, Dan Hatman is my guest. I'm going to give you one last question to leave you on here. You know, is there one player, one or two, I don't know, but anybody who you think is just, wow, I'm surprised this guy hasn't gotten a little bit more buzz, or the tape reveals a great player, whereas the numbers haven't shown out. Is there a name out there that you think listeners and draft fanatics should be a little more aware of than maybe they are at this point?
I would love to be talking more about Lorenzo Carter.
Ah, interesting.
It's not just because he's big and athletic, yep, although he is big and athletic. But I, you know, we look at a coach in Kirby Smart. They came out of a program in Alabama for a long, long time with Nick Saban. So if they take a guy and they ask him to do a lot, chances are the player's pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just the way their system operates, you know, if you have a limited scope, they will put you in a limited scope. You know, so for a guy like Lorenzo that did as many things as he did at Georgia under a coach like Kirby Smart, intrigues me. Like, okay, they clearly trust him to do a lot of things. You got a big athletic guy that level of coach deemed could do a lot of things. And then you look at what those things were, dropped in coverage and showed effectiveness.
Yep.
Run defense from a stacked and line of scrimmage perspective, did those effectively. Pass rush off the edge, did that effectively. And then the thing that gets me most excited is he just tries. Like, he's going and he's giving effort and he's getting after it. And trust me, that's not a universal thing for a football player, particularly one that does have that kind of size and athletic ability. A lot of those guys aren't pushed or don't push themselves to max out effort because they don't have to. You know, I can get by without doing as much. Well, he's giving it. He's trying. You know, I understand that some people are concerned, like, what do I do with him? To me, this is like people that start asking, what do I do with Minka or Derwin James, right, you know, who line up in the slot all the time. Their college coach told you what to do with them.
Right.
He showed you what to do with them. We're talking about these guys. They are hopefully first-round picks, very high, very capable. Don't overthink this. Let them do a lot. They can do a lot. You know, line them up in unique – they're unique body types and players. Just use them as such. If your defensive coordinator can't figure out how to play a guy like Lorenzo Carter,
right,
I don't know. I got maybe I need to have a conversation with him because it's 2-2 doesn't equal 4 on that one.
Right. Oh, hey, I watched the two playoff games back to back. You watched the Oklahoma game. He's standing up. He's playing in space. They had him out, you know, covering the tight end or the fullback or whatever. And then you watch the Alabama game, and he's got his hand in the dirt. He's playing both sides, and he's, you know, setting the edge. So I see exactly what you're talking about. I'd like to see, obviously, a little more production. But, man, I think I'm right there with you. He's one of those that I may have overlooked a little bit early in the process, and never, you know, didn't quite get hip to until just recently.
Well, I see a lot of buzz for a couple of guys. There's a young man at his pass rusher. There's a young man at Rutgers, Kimoko Ture. There's a young man at Florida State, Josh Sweat. And a lot of people are saying because of how those players were used, Josh was lined up on the tackle on a four-eye a lot. Ture was, again, kind of a stand-up jack-of-all. You know, if you just pin their ears back and let them go, they can be more. Well, I can make the same argument for Carter. He did a lot, therefore he doesn't have as many TFLs or sacks as other quote-unquote pass rushers would have. But he also didn't line up and do that from a huge percentage. I'd be interested in his production in those areas is simply as a percentage of the snaps where he was given the opportunity to go do that. I would imagine they'd be pretty good.
Yeah, outstanding stuff. I'm glad you brought him up, and I'm sure our listeners are too. So, Dan Hatman, thank you so much. I want to pub it one more time, the ITP Draft Guide. Go to itpdraftguide.com. Inside the pylon, promo code, I believe you said, was PFW5 for $5 off. Did I have that right?
Correct.
Outstanding. Well, it's great work. And like I said, I'm going to keep digging into it. I read a couple of the profiles, the level of detail, the injuries going back to high school for some guys, just the amount of work put into these things is really, truly phenomenal. And Dan, thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right, talk to you soon, buddy. And thank you all to the Pro Football Weekly listeners out there. Keep checking us out on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts.